I believe the time is about 11:15, so I think we'll go ahead and gather for our cybersecurity session.
Left or right?
For those of you who just joined us, my name's Christy Hilsman, and I'm a communications manager with NFA. Welcome, if you just arrived. Before we get started with our cyber content, I just wanted to provide a couple of housekeeping reminders, again, for those of you who may have just walked in. First and foremost, we are doing an audio recording of today's workshop. So if you'd like to raise a question for our speakers at any point in time, I'd really appreciate it if you'd raise a hand so we can get you a microphone and can record your questions. Additionally, wanted to remind everybody that there are evaluations on the tables that you're all sitting at. So prior to leaving, if you could fill those out for us, that would be great as well. And without further ado, I know we have a lot of content to cover. I want to hand things over to our cyber speakers. So we're going to start with a cyber update from a few of my colleagues. Sudhir is back from the morning. And then we've also got Lou Baradoco. He's a senior manager of examinations and compliance. And then we also have Julio Reed with us. He is a cybersecurity compliance manager, examinations compliance with us at NFA. So with that, I will turn it over to you guys.
Thank you, Christy. I do like the title, Cyber Speaker. It's pretty good. Thank you again for being here today. In this session, we'll cover three different topics. We'll talk about the recent changes we have made to our interpretive notice. I'll cover that. And then Lou talk about how the mechanics of filing and a notice for cybersecurity incident at your firm, if at all it happens. And then Julio talk about exam observations and what we are seeing in this area in the industry. We do have a very esteemed panel towards the end, so I do look forward to that. Let me start with a little bit of background. As you are aware that NFA's interpretive notice on Information System Security Program, ISSP, became effective on March 1, 2016. It has been about 3 years, and since then, we have included in scope cybersecurity in almost every exam. And during the exams and during other discussions with member firms, what we have realized is there are some common questions which you have raised. So we wanted to update the interpretive notice to address those questions. They particularly relate to training and the approval of the ISSP. Additionally, our current ISSP does not talk about members reporting to NFA in the event of a cybersecurity incident, so we are adding that new requirement. Those are the three changes we are making starting April 1st, 2019, and I'll cover those in a little bit detail now. Okay, starting with training. With respect to training, the interpretive notice provided that the members should identify the relevant personnel and then train them upon hire and periodically thereafter. The questions we have been getting is, what does periodically really mean? So we wanted to clarify that, and then there were also questions about what should be included in training, how the training should be provided. So we are providing a little bit of guidance out there as well. The two key changes we are making is, first, we are asking the members to identify in their written ISSP the training topics they would cover for cybersecurity training. We are going to give some examples of what topics can be covered, but we are keeping it flexible because different members have different types of business, different size of business, and the way they operate is very different. So we did not want to lay out a basic requirement for all of the members. It would not have made sense. That's why we are leaving it on to you, but we do want you to identify those topics and in your written ISSP. The second change we are making is about the frequency of the training program. We are retaining that you have to train upon hiring, and then we are saying it would be annual thereafter. So instead of periodically, we are asking you to train your employees annually afterwards. We do want the firms to consider if a more frequent training would be required, given your situation. So if, let's say, there is a big event, cybersecurity incident at your firm, or firm similar to yours, or if you make big changes to your systems, to your ISSP, you may consider doing more frequent training. We are again leaving the flexibility out there for you to determine how this training should be done. It could be email reminders, it could be classroom sessions, it could be short videos which you post on your website and then direct people out there. It does not have to be the same format as initial training, but do consider what else might be required. The second thing I want to talk about is the approval of the ISSP. One of the things which was not commonly understood, as we found out in our exams, was what does the executive level official mean? So the current ISSP says that a written ISSP can be approved in writing by either the CEO, the CTO, or an executive level official. We are replacing the word executive level official with a senior official who is a registered principal. So we are defining it a little bit more and taking out the ambiguity from who that individual can be. If you are participating in an entity level ISSP, which many of you do, we still would require the member firm's CEO, CTO, CISO, or a senior official who is a registered principal to approve the ISSP in writing. The last bit which I want to talk about is the new requirement. So as I said, our current interpretive notice talks about members' incident response plan, and it also talks about how members should communicate with different law enforcement agencies and different external stakeholders. It does not, though, say that members should report to NFA should a cyber incident happen at their firm. Going forward, we'll require you to report to us any cybersecurity incident which happens at your firm, which you discover on or after April 1st, 2019. We are defining a cybersecurity incident in a very narrow sense, and there are two important aspects to it. One, it has to be related to your commodity interest business. What I mean is, if you are a retail bank, if you are a big universal bank, and something happens on your retail side and customer funds were lost, we are not looking for you to notify us of that. However, if something happens on the derivatives business side, we would be looking for that notice to be filed. So it should be related to your cybersecurity incident. It should lead to a loss of either funds for the member's own capital, or funds of your customer or counterparty. So those two things have to be satisfied. We would require you to notify to us if you are notifying your customers pursuant to any state or federal law, limited to U.S. state and federal laws, and even if you are voluntarily reporting to your customers or counterparty that an incident happened to at your firm. I think that concludes my part. I'll take a pause. I went through a lot pretty quickly, but I'm happy to take any questions at this moment, and then I'll turn it over to Lou to talk about the mechanics of how to file a cyber incident if at all it happens at your firm. Any questions at this point?
Yes, hello. Quick question on approval of the ISSP. You listed three different categories. You listed CEO, senior level officer, such as CTO, as well as a principal. Are these all three categories that need to be checked, or are you looking for one of those categories, or perhaps can the same person satisfy all two of them or three of them?
Good question. It could be any of those people. It could be any of those individuals. So a CTO can sign or a CISO can sign. If your firm does not have a person designated as such, the person who is performing those responsibilities and has the oversight of ISSP can still sign. They don't have to have the title. But the CEO would have the title, and a senior official, if it is not the CTO or the CISO, then the senior official has to be a registered principal. but any one of them would satisfy. If you're doing an approval by committee, as long as one of those individuals sit on that committee, a committee approval would also suffice.
Yeah, I have a question here.
So go ahead.
For the training module, is it okay that one module covers all the employees, or you expect the module to be tailor-made as to the specific role of that employee?
As I said, we left it on the firms to decide what works best for you. Tailor the module depending on what role and what function those employees perform. Having said that, you can have a very comprehensive training and have all of your employees go through it. That would also work for us.
I just wanted to acknowledge the point you made about being flexible regarding training, but explore if you have any concerns in making a distinction between training and awareness. When you mentioned, for instance, sending emails, right? Emails are by definition passive. You know, we can send them. We have no clue whether they were read, as opposed to where there's an affirmation of some sort that you took some training, whether you clicked through or what have you, and you said, you did that. Do you make that distinction between what we'll typically see as awareness, whether they are posters, emails, or what have you, and a formal, session of acknowledging that you did take training?
That's a very interesting question. For the initial on-hire training and for the annual training, I would expect it to be a little more formal. It cannot be probably emails. However, if you had one particular incident and you just want people to be aware, it would be fine to send an email. Having said that, when you do the training next time, you may want to revisit that thing and talk about it. If the incident is that serious that the firm decides and thinks that it would make sense to get everybody in a room or have everyone go through an online training, that is what should be done. So we were not trying to figure out that if this happens, you do an email, and if this happens, you do a classroom training, but you are right. I mean, there are cases where an awareness email would be sufficient. There are cases where you would have to do more than that.
Is this going to be across all types of NFA members, or is this specifically for the CPOs, CTAs, and the SDs that we've been talking about earlier?
That's across all type of NFA members.
Thank you.
For the notice requirement up there now, if you notify your counterparty pursuant to a contractual commitment you've made, there's no state or federal law requiring it, that would not trigger this requirement?
We would expect you to file a notice with us as well in that case.
Okay.
I would turn it over to Lou to talk about the mechanics of how to file a notice. I realize there might be more questions, but if we save it towards the end, and we can hang out a little bit after the session as well if you have more questions. Over to you.
Thanks, Sudhir. Okay, so cyber incident notice filings are going to be submitted for EasyFile for all registration categories. EasyFile can be accessed through the electronic filing systems page on NFA's website. Once you log in and access the system, you'll be able to see the firm's filing index, which may include other regulatory notices that you've filed in the past. To create a cyber incident notice, you're going to be able to click on Create Filing. And then once you're there, you'll have this screen pop up where it'll be the Create New Filing box, where you'll be able to select a cybersecurity incident notice and then enter a date discovery. Filings are required for incidents which occur on or after April 1st. Clicking Save will then create the notice. Once the notice has been created, you'll see it in the filing index page, along with any other notices you might have filed in the past. To complete the notice, you'll click on the end date for the one that you just created, which then this screen is going to pop up. So on this screen is pretty much the information that we're looking to collect from the member firm. There's four key areas: the cyber incident type, the monetary loss value, contact information, and uploading. So as far as the incident type goes, it has the three main areas that Sudhir mentioned: the loss of customer or counterparty funds, loss of firm capital, loss of customer or counterparty information, and we've also included other. You can select more than one incident from this section. For the monetary loss section, completing this section will depend on the incident type that you select above. So for example, if you select a loss of customer or counterparty funds, this section will actually hide. However, if you select a loss of firm capital, you will be prompted to enter a dollar value in the box. As far as contact information, you will need to provide the information on who's submitting the notice to us. That includes the preparer's name, title, phone number, and email address. And then for the uploading section, a written summary of the incident can be uploaded in instances where the notice is not provided to customers or counterparties, or where the firm is prohibited by law by providing a copy of the notice to NFA. If the notice is provided to customers or counterparties and you're able to provide a copy, you can upload it here in lieu of submitting a written summary. If identical notices are provided to multiple parties, you're only required to provide one copy of this notice. Once you complete that, you can either click Save at the top or the bottom of the screen, and it'll save your work. Once you've completed the form and uploaded your documents, you would click Next to complete the filing. The next section of the filing completes some edit checks based on what you've entered to ensure that the form is complete. You can go back to the filing for any errors that populate by either clicking back to filing or just directly clicking on one of the descriptions of the error that populated. So here for the next slide. So once all the errors are fixed, you'll be prompted to submit the filing. You can also go back to the filing as needed to include any additional information. Once done, you'll click Submit Filing again. And then here it brings you to a part of the notice filing where you'll be required to attest that the information that you submitted is accurate and complete. When you're ready to submit the filing, you just click Submit Filing. And should you need to amend the filing at any point after you submitted it, you can always go back to the original filing index and re-click on there and amend it. So at this point, I'm going to pause to ask if there's any specific questions about the system.
So I have a question on the filing. I notice a checkbox for loss of customer counterparty information, but I don't see that as one of the requirements for filing the incident notice. So,
yeah. What we are trying to get there is, in case you have a loss of customer funds or your customer funds, and you also lost customer PII or other information, you check both of it. But if you only lost customer information, you don't have to file a notice with us. Does it make sense?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question. So, I'm just following up on that. So if like your third party administrator has a cyber incident, because you don't really maintain your books and records, and they notify the clients based on their cyber policy, and there's no loss of funds, it's kind of books and records situation, you're not required to file this notice filing with the NFA.
If you are notifying your...
No loss of money.
I'm sorry,
there's no loss of funds.
Right.
Your books and records are maintained by a third-party administrator.
Mm-hmm.
They have the cyber incident. You're not required to file this.
Right. So even if you are voluntarily reporting to your customers or counterparties, we would require you to file a notice with us.
That's not just what you said, though. If there's a cyber incident with your customers, but you have a third-party administrator, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have the incident, because you don't maintain your own books and records. You have a third-party administrator. You're not required to file if there's no loss of customer funds or counterparty loss, right?
Okay. So let me say that one more time. If there's a loss of funds...
No loss of
funds. It's pretty clear. If there's no loss of fund, but you are reporting to your counterparty or customers, you would still have to file a notice with us.
I think we're not saying the same thing.
Let me take it offline with you, if that is okay.
Do you understand what the gentleman who's discussing this actual?
As far as like next steps go, we are actually going to be sending out a notice to members in March, which has frequently asked questions that may come up. So as Sudhir was saying, you know, maybe we could take this offline, or we can discuss this further prior to our frequently asked questions coming out. But as far as the frequently asked questions go, we're going to be updating our self-exam questionnaire and also our regulatory reporting guidelines. But I mean, as far as kind of answering that question again, I do kind of get the gist of what you're saying. But what Sudhir is saying is that if you as the firm are required to actually send notice to your customers that your third party lost some type of the customer's information,
you would be required
to submit that to us.
But they, as a third-party administrator, would send a notice to the clients. Are you as an NFA member required to file this notice? That's my question.
I see
if
what you're saying.
If there's no loss of funds.
Okay.
And you're not actually the reporter because you have a contract with your administrator.
We'll do this. I get your question now. It's more focused on third party rather than having an incident, rather than you having an incident. We'll discuss this and we'll clarify this in the FAQ, which we are going to probably release in a couple of weeks or so. So we'll address it. I understand what you're saying, and we can clarify that in our FAQ.
So I would just suggest, if you could give us examples. I think it would just help us, and you did already mention that you're going to have the frequently asked questions, but if you could give us some examples as you go through, that would also help us determine how we're supposed to proceed. And, you know, maybe also just in terms of the amount, if there's an amount that needs to, an amount threshold that needs to be addressed, we would appreciate that.
Yeah. There is no materiality threshold, so even if you lost a dollar, you'd have to notify to us. And what examples are we talking about? That part is not clear to me. The FAQ would definitely talk about, you know, things you should consider in your training, cases where you would have to notify to NFA, and cases where you did not lose funds, but you are voluntarily reporting to your customer. What do you do in those cases? And I get the third party question. It's an interesting one. So we'll look to address that as well. If there's any other feedback, we are happy to take that.
Right. And to piggyback on Sudhir's comment, in reference to most of the third party contract relationships that most firms have, if the third party has such any kind of breach of that nature, and if the third party has confirmed that the data that it's managing on behalf of that firm has not been altered or infected of any sort, once you get full confirmation from them that states that your data is fine, in regards to Sudhir's reference, it's likely that you'll still have to provide notice, but however, if they confirm that the data is that they're housing for you is safe, then it's something that you probably shouldn't have to concern from that level.
So if I can just jump in here for one second. This is Joe Zangria. I started the conference for those of you who weren't here. I wanted to go back to the question that was asked earlier of Sudhir, which is, if you have a third-party vendor who has a cyber incident, and that third-party vendor notifies your clients of that incident, do you as a member have an obligation to report to the NFA? If the third-party vendor is reporting to your clients per an agreement that you have with that third-party vendor, then you should report.
This is Dale. Just to clarify for the sake of perhaps a CPO that is using an admin, the relationship that you have, they are your customers. So if there is a notification that is provided to your customers or participants as it relates to perhaps a breach of personally identifiable information, for example, even if your admin provides it, they are acting as your agent. We would expect that filing is made with us.
Okay. So in interest of time, we're just going to quickly move on, and like Sudhir said, if anybody else has any questions, we can always move forward. This remote's not working again. So quickly, I was just going to go through some quick exam observations that we're continually seeing. We've talked about this in the last couple of previous workshops. Up on the screen are just some procedural deficiencies that we continue to routinely see on examinations that our teams go out to. In addition to the procedural deficiencies, we're also continually seeing some training-related deficiencies and ISSP review deficiencies, which hopefully the updates to the INTERP will hopefully address going forward. So now I'm going to pass it over to Julio to discuss some known incidents.
Okay. So some of the known incidents that's occurring within, also from common industry standpoint, includes ransomware. I'm sure quite a number of personnel have familiar with this particular incident. Ransomware basically is which a bad actor infiltrates the organization, captures some amount of data, encrypts the data, and in return it requests transfer of funds in order for you to retrieve the data that they have captured. Basically, it's target more for specific spear phishing attacks where it targets specific areas related to possibly the accounting or the financial area. Most of the remediation towards these particular type of attacks include making sure that you have a strong backup system that's occurring, that you have strong patch management on your servers to identify if there is such activity going on the servers, as well as considering using proxy servers, which is a software that emulates the interpretation that you have, your own desktop, and that you're working from the server itself. Other incident types include fraudulent requests to transfer funds. Basically, this is also another spear phishing attack in which there needs to be a maker-checker controls in place to confirm that certain issuance of funds are confirmed to be issued in the specified sources. Ideally, certain controls to put against this will include making sure that there's possibly a whitelist of defined sources to receive funds, and also making sure that there's a secondary reviewer that's performed in regards to funds transfer and finalize. Unauthorized access to sensitive information. Basically, it's in which access controls are being circumvented and able to access certain areas where there isn't a need to know. Key controls to incorporate to prevent this will be multi-factor authentication, making sure that strong encryptions are in place, access control lists, and confirming that there's proper segregation of duties that exist. As far as best practices in reference, the key ones includes execute response recovery plan. Making sure that you have a defined, documented response recovery plan in place is key. And making sure that this response and recovery plan can address certain incidents in relation to the incident characteristics as well as the criticality of the incidents. You might want to consider implementing a call tree where you have to incorporate certain other areas from the firm related to compliance, PR, and legal. Notifying or engaging counsel. Counsel should be considered to be engaged, especially if there's any specific material breaches, as well as during performance in investigations. They'll also be assisting in areas related to litigation counseling, as well as confidential information. They can also provide direction in those regards. In reference to considering hiring third-party investigations, this is if you don't have any in-house personnel that can perform this activity, or if you're utilizing an existing vendor that you can leverage to perform this level of investigation. As far as notifying regulars, customers, and counterparties, this is something where we feel that as far as utilizing legal area, this is something where legal can be pretty much leveraged in this area. In contacting other regulators, we consider NFA to be one of the regulators that you will contact in reference to any particular incidents. reaching out to law enforcement. This can be the local FBI office, civil, as well as local Department of Justice areas. It's a possibility that some of these incidents or breaches could have a certain precedence that has occurred in other organizations or firms, and that they have a history not only in addressing this issue, but also to incorporate certain controls to prevent it from occurring again in the future. Notifying banks of funds, notifying bank if funds are involved. Ideally, you want to notify the banks as soon as possible, and this is something you can work with your legal department to make sure this is done in order to possibly recuperate as much of the funds that's been lost. Notify the insurance company. Basically, most insurance companies are still trying to get their hands around providing adequate policy in relation to cybersecurity. However, working with the insurance company, they can provide a scope of coverage for financial resources, as well as providing some level of direction and subject matter expertise in relation to certain incidents and breaches that has occurred. They also has a history in maintaining best practices, not only obtained from industry standards, but also possibly some of the other clients that they have. In relation to the SAR report, financial institution must file a suspicious activity report following certain cyber events. IBs, FCMs should consider if they experience a cyber event, whether it defines a suspicious activity report or not. FinCEN has previously issued advisories related to cybersecurity, and if an incident involves 5,000 or more, you should determine whether or not a SAR should be filed. And then, as far as my last point, update to ISSP to incorporate lessons learned. From our observations, some of the key lessons learned that's been incorporated is ensuring that the incident plans are fully documented and updated periodically. Automate as much of the incident process as you can. This will not only help in the efficiency to rectify the incident, but also provide a finite amount of information that you can use for investigations. Also, centralizing the incident process. There's been a number of firms who have multiple activities going on simultaneously in reference to incidents. By centralizing the activity, you can help streamline the efficiency and rectifying the incident as quickly as possible. Are there any questions? She's coming.
It's coming over.
Great, thank you. So I know the FFIEC does have an inherent risk assessment and a maturity assessment that's used by a lot of us. You know, does the NFA, would the NFA look at that or utilize that tool in any sense, to look at member firms?
As far as looking at, you're talking about the cybersecurity incident
yes.
framework. NFA doesn't look at that specifically. However, we look at the processes that is performed in-house of your firm and how you're leveraging the cybersecurity in relation to areas related such as incident management, asset management, and third-party risk controls. So we're not looking to see that the framework that is being used in-house. We're looking to see how you're applying it and you're utilizing it on a BAU business activity use day-to-day.
So at this point, in the interest of time, our contact information is here up on the screens, and I'm going to invite Dale Sperl-Jerick up for the second half of our cyber panel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Over. We are in the process, as Lou mentioned, updating our FAQs on the cybersecurity updates. So please keep your questions coming. We'll make sure to work in the comments and questions that we haven't already addressed in that updated document to make it clear on some of the issues that you're bringing forth. So with that being said, this is the member panel discussion. I am Dale Spolgerik. I'm a managing director in the compliance department at NFA. Our department's responsible for covering everybody but the swap dealers, so your FCMs, CPOs, CTAs, IBs, FDMs. And with me today, I have two gentlemen. To my immediate left here is Carl Schimmick. He is global head of vulnerability management at Morgan Stanley. Now, Morgan Stanley, through its various affiliates, holds registrations in almost all of the available NFA membership categories. Carl's responsible for the discovery of and oversight of the remediation of vulnerabilities discovered within the corporate computing environment. To Carl's left is David Pollack. He is general counsel of Lighthouse Investment Partners, LLC, which is a registered CPO CTA based in Florida with locations across the globe. In his current role, David oversees Lighthouse's legal and compliance departments. And as I think my job today is going to be very easy because both of these individuals have expertise in the cyber area and are eager to share their insights. So I think we're going to have a good discussion today. In setting out this panel, we sketched out three broad areas to dig into a little bit. But please feel free to ask questions as we go along. We can take the panel wherever the audience seems to derive the most benefit. The first area involves the process of developing and managing your ISSP. So our interpretive notice, obviously being from NFA, as a threshold matter, our first interest and priority is making sure that the activities that require you to be registered with NFA are covered adequately in the ISSP. But we understand that there are many members that have multiple business lines and a lot of different activities. So maybe, David, I'll start with you and give you the big question. How do you ensure all of your activities and operations are adequately covered in an ISSP?
I'm not sure I like the word ensure. We do our best, and I think, you know, looking at the interpretive guidance from the NFA, one of the things that we appreciated was the recognition that it was going to be different for different firms because it was going to be very specific. And we do have different business lines. We are CTA, CPO, Registered Investment Advisor. We have operations across the world. So we are trying to manage to that sort of highest common denominator to have a best practice that covers not just the NFA rules, the SEC rules, and the other rules that we deal with. And the solution for us, as we found it, and it's a similar solution in many different areas, is really finding the right people, having the right policies and processes, doing the right training, and having the right technology. So really, those are the solutions for us. In the areas of people, it's insourcing the expertise on the cyber side and setting up relationships with vendors. We don't have the size to have all those folks internal, so we've gone out and located vendors who help us with technology, hardware, and software. We've located vendors who help us with penetration testing and drafting our policies and procedures and helping us there. And we'll talk about tabletop exercises in a little bit, but when we went through one of those, we realized if we did suffer attack, we were sort of sitting around the room saying, well, what next? And we needed someone to help us and sort of, I don't want to say babysit, but if we were, let's say, attacked, a ransomware attack or something else, okay, what do we do now? We sort of sat around the room and said, I guess we might pay the ransom. How do we get Bitcoin? How do we do all these things? So we reached out, sourced a vendor who we have under contract now to help us with those things. So that was sort of the people part of it. The training part is a lot of guided by, you know, the regulations, but there's, as you say, we do training on when someone's hired. We do training periodically. As issues come up in the market, we learn about threats. We make sure people are aware of them. And then we do an annual training with outside vendors who come in and do training and sort of explain to our employees what's out there and that they're on the front lines and explaining what the threats might be. Not try to scare them, but it is frankly very scary, and try to get them on the team of understanding that this is not just something that's out in the ether. You really have to be focused on cybersecurity, and if you're not, you might be that patient zero that allows someone in, and that's going to have serious consequences. So training is a big part of it. And then, you know, policies and procedures. You know, we do these tabletop exercises. We figure out policies that really work. We figure out what a response may look like. We try to have policies and procedures that really, you know, a lot of our employees find them very annoying. Some of our clients find them annoying, but they really had to do things. We had to do things that were going to make things less convenient for employees and clients, but make us safer. So a good example there is, you know, over time, technology got to the point where it was so easy to do a remote desktop or dial in from somewhere using an old term to do your work at home or from somewhere else or on the road. But what we found out was that opened us up to all sorts of risk. And, you know, Carl's going to be able to comment on it better than I can, but having that ability to dial in from anywhere opens the door to cyber threats. And so we really use that as an example of, okay, we have to change our policies and procedures based on a threat that's, you know, if you look at the common threats they're always coming in through that way. It's a very common way to get in. So we saw the fact that, you know, people groaned, but they got used to it. And then finally, technology. We have technology that, software that is, you know, more attuned toward cyber attacks and tell us when we have a ransomware attack or when we think we have something. We have hardware that can tell us if someone's trying to do a brute force attack on our system. We didn't have that in the past, meaning if someone's throwing a million passwords and IDs at your system to your server that's pointed out to the World Wide Web, we didn't know we potentially had an attack. Then we put this system in place and we said, oh my goodness, look at all these things that are happening. So the final piece for us was technology. So those sort of four elements, for people, policies, training, and technology.
And you beautifully touched on a lot of things that I think we'll get into a bit here. And I would imagine that there may be some CCOs in the room or people who support the CCO. Another question, maybe as a follow-up to that, what do you see as the CCO's role in doing all of that?
You know, admittedly, I thought it used to be just, you know, be aware of the policies and procedures and kind of inform the firm and the IT department about what's going on. What I quickly learned is that just doing that was not enough. You really had to dig in to understand what's going on so you could be a leader on that type of issue. So if you just know what the SEC and the NFA wants and then you just kind of hand it on a plate to the IT department, the implementation is probably not that good. If you really want to be a leader at your firm with cybersecurity, you have to actually dig into it. And I'm not saying you have to become the IT director, but you have to have basic understanding of how your systems and infrastructure are set up. So again, I go back to the remote access that we gave our employees. It was very convenient, but when I dug into it and I looked at the threats, I realized that was opening a door to cyber threats, and that was opening the door to hackers. And when you looked and we spoke to our vendors, we realized, you know, half the ransom attacks were coming in through remote access or remote desktop protocols. And we said, well, this is silly. And, you know, had I not sort of sat down with IT and said, okay, how does this work and understand the processes? And again, I'm not an expert on IT. I'll leave that to Carl. But I think you have to do, if you really want to be a leader on it and you really want to understand it, you have to dig a little deeper. If you're just sort of presenting the policies and procedures and, you know, and leaving it there, I don't think it's enough. I think you really have to go to the next level if you want to be a leader on it.
And touching on something else you mentioned, obviously being at both of your entities, you deal with more than just NFA. How do either one of you manage the expectations that come with multiple regulators asking you questions about cybersecurity?
Yeah, so typically what we do at Morgan Stanley is we take a firm-based approach to our cybersecurity program, so we look at it, you know, across all of our entities and very much try to take a risk-based approach and do what's best, you know, based on us from a global standpoint. Then there'll be specific questions and things that each one of the regulators may want to know about. And what we'll do is then kind of tune our responses, whether it be specifically to an entity that might be covered by a regulator or in a region or whatever the case might be. But, you know, a big push that we're making and a lot of our peers are making across the sector is really how can we lower the compliance costs as we look across all these different cybersecurity regulations that are coming out, because there's, you know, a tremendous amount of overlap. There are a lot of the questions are the same. You know, in many cases, we don't implement controls specifically for entities. We try to, again, do them at a firm-wide basis unless there are specific threats we have to entities or regions. So, you know, where we can, we align to, in our case, the NIST cybersecurity framework is our starting point, and in many ways that guides what we do. We then will overlay FFIC CAT and then a number of the other regulations that are there as we try to, you know, kind of get to that more holistic picture and just make sure that, you know, in this day and age where, you know, talent is difficult to come by from a cybersecurity standpoint, we're using our talent really in first line to defend and protect the firm versus respond to questionnaires or compliance required things. Now, that being said, when we talk about the compliance portion to it, I mean, we've taken very much the three lines of defense approach, where we are using second line, in our case, operational risk, and then third line audit to very much challenge whatever policies and procedures are in place, making sure that they're implemented properly, that we can evidence them. But we found that that's really, I think, a very important part of all your programs is making sure that you have that internal capability to challenge what's going on. And in many cases, not being a technologist and then challenging the technologist is a very good thing. Because, you know, in many cases, if you can't understand it as a risk manager, or you can't understand it as a person who does compliance, then in some cases, that may not be as fully deployed as you think it is. So I think being able to take it into layman's terms, understanding and communicating that, you know, throughout and cascading it throughout the organization is an important point for the way your controls are put into place, for what protections you have, making sure they're complete. And then also understanding sort of where there may be gaps and are you making conscious decisions based on risk analysis of, I have a gap there, I'm okay with that because I have maybe an overlapping control, or because the cost is so outrageous compared to the threat that it may be mitigating. So I think it's a lot of different things at play, but having the risk component to this, you know, kind of overlaying it is very important because, you know, I think it's, you know, it's David had said, you know, insure is a very tough thing here. You know, there's no 100% guarantees. It's, you know, you take a best approach, best effort, you'll be able to demonstrate that, and you want to protect yourself from as much as you possibly can based on what might be targeting you.
Great. So I'll pause briefly before getting to maybe some specifics and threats. Are there any questions? No? Okay. So maybe turning a little bit more into some of the specifics and the technology maybe that's involved. With threats and protection, Carl, understanding that the environment is constantly changing, what at the moment concerns you the most?
Sure. So this is, I think, from taking a kind of a big firm approach to it, you know, and everybody will have different threats that they're facing depending on kind of what your profile is, where you're deployed, you have offices from a regional standpoint, and kind of what your business type is. For us, very much, we kind of break it down into really three areas. One is, you know, a advanced persistent threat or a nation state type of attack. So we look at, you know, your typical threat actors of Iran, North Korea, Russia, China. You know, are they looking to steal data, disrupt operations, or maybe in theft in the case of North Korea, as seen through some of the recent attacks using the SWIFT network. Then you also have just straight up criminals. They're looking to steal money. They're looking to steal data, using that in some way to gain some money from that. And you know, those are come in a wide variety of, you know, capabilities and different kind of different profiles. And then lastly, your hacktivists, which have not been very active lately, but you know, they're looking to deface, they're looking to cause, you know, reputational damage to a firm, not looking to steal money, but you know, kind of you need to take them into account. So as you kind of break those apart, there's, you know, what we do is we use a number of different vendors out there that will give us kind of threat information. One that's very good and we highly recommend is the FSISAC. It's not very costly. It's something that there's now almost 8,000 members of across the globe. So it's something, if you're not a member of FSISAC, highly recommend you do it. You get a lot of great threat information for free or for very low cost. And it can just kind of tie you into kind of what's sort of going on around the industry, as well as allow you to share information with your peers, which that's oftentimes where we get our best data, is when we understand sort of what other firms are facing, what scanning they might be experiencing, what attacks they've been able to mitigate, and then we can kind of prepare ourselves to see if we're seeing kind of a trend start to form across the industry. But you know, at the end of the day, I think, you know, it's very much, you know, taking one general approach isn't going to work for everybody. You want to sort of think about what your profile is, you know, where are you located, who might want to do you harm, and then use that as a key input into where you want to deploy your controls, spend your money, protect what might be necessary. Because again, like providing 100% coverage in many cases is going to be very difficult, or in many cases too costly to do. So use your money, you know, as wisely as you can.
So our view from the CTA, CPO seat, you know, there's sort of four main things, a little more simplistic way of viewing it probably is, worried about data exfiltration, you know, people taking our clients' PII or proprietary information about the firm, whatever their motivation is. From speaking to our vendors, it's typically for folks like us, money, they want ransom. They're going to either lock up our files and say, you know, pay us or we're not going to unlock your files, or they're going to threaten to put our files or proprietary information on the web if we don't pay their ransom. So that's what we're hearing from our vendor who works with other similar like shops. That's what they're seeing. In fact, I was speaking to our vendor in preparation for this conference, and they told me they're seeing up to 9 attacks a day, and client, you know, from folks like ourselves being attacked. That's one vendor in one place seeing 9 attacks a day in sort of a ransom context. We worry about just the, you know, not just the exfiltration of data, but just a ransom attack. They're not interested in taking the data; they just want to lock it up and get paid. Obviously, that's going to be very disruptive to your business. You know, a lot of people may have trouble paying the ransom. A lot of people may not know how to deal with it. A lot of folks might not be able to rely on their backup. So a ransom attack is also something we're particularly worried about. We're also really worried about sort of a less in the cyber, more social engineering. Someone calling up and someone in our investor relations department on a Friday afternoon and trying to convince them to change the wire instruction. Someone's going to try to convince someone to do something they're not supposed to do in line with processes, which usually require callbacks and confirmations. Really concerned about that, you know, that's where money's going out the door. A lot of times insurance may not cover that. That's reputational harm. That's particularly concerning us. And then finally, we're worried about the people we work with, whether it's clients or vendors, being subject to attack without our knowledge. You know, we pay a lot of vendors by wire. We pay clients by wires when we're dealing with redemption. So if one of them were to be, you know, exposed or compromised, we may not know and then be sending out information. So we do spend a lot of time with our clients and our vendors working on things. We have a lot of procedures around calling back and confirming that if something is changed, that it's confirmed. So someone changing a wire instruction, whether it's a vendor or a client, is going to send up all sorts of red flags, and everybody's going to freak out and make sure it's actually really true. And we probably overdo it on it, but any change like that is going to raise a lot of red flags. So those are sort of the, in our current environment, I'm sure it will change. Those are sort of the things that we worry about on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. You touched on something that perhaps maybe we could spend a little time on. We got the question earlier about a breach at an admin. You may be aware the CFTC took an enforcement action against a commodity pool operator for a breach at an admin where funds were lost. David, you just mentioned, you know, callbacks and things and working with mm-hmm. vendors. Are there any other specific things that maybe a member could do to help prevent things that may occur at a counterparty or a customer even where they're compromised?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's sort of back to the future. We've moved away from anything email related. It's on the phone. We're actually requiring forms to be submitted. If someone's got an advisor that we're working with, we're going to call the advisor. We may require a specific call with the end client. We may actually require a fax from a known fax number. It's kind of going back in time a little bit to make sure that someone's not using, you know, email or the web to kind of fool us. And then it's just having really set policies and procedures. If this is what you're going to do to change a wire instruction, if someone's going to change a wire instruction, these are the 5 steps that have to be done. Everything has to be checked off. So there's a checklist that has to be followed without exception and sign-offs. And those things are going to prevent, hopefully, that type of risk.
You also mentioned cyber insurance. What's involved in that? What should members look out for if they're interested in cyber insurance?
I think what they want to do is I assume most members will have just basic insurance, D&O, E&O coverage, maybe a crime policy or an employee policy. They want to first take a look at what their current policy holds and see what coverage they have, and then try to fill in the gaps with potential cyber. What's interesting about the cyber market, and it's still maturing, is it's a little bit of a service and less and more about insurance. They're going to put you in touch with a breach negotiator who will deal with the hacker. They may put you in touch with privacy counsel who will help you through the process. But you also have to think about, they may require you to use their vendors. So if you have vendors you like, you want to make sure you have coverage that allows you to have that freedom. They may step in when your coverage doesn't cover things like the cost of dealing with a breach or the cost of providing your clients with credit monitoring and things of that nature. What they often don't cover, though, is the social sort of breach that occurs. Someone calls up and fools someone and money goes out the door. Cyber coverage probably doesn't cover that. That's going to be more if you have crime coverage. So I definitely would encourage folks to talk to their brokers. It's still insurance brokers. It's still a somewhat immature market, so you really want to understand what you're paying for. On the other hand, it's still a pretty soft market, so you can get coverage. So for this year, we're signing up for roughly $5 million in coverage. I think that makes sense for our size. We're about $15 billion in AUM. That's going to cost us under $30,000. For us, that seems like a no-brainer. You could probably get $3 million of coverage for around $20,000 and so on and so forth down the line. But I think the service aspect is really interesting, which is, hey, I need Bitcoin. This insurance company will provide Bitcoin to pay the ransom. Hey, I need someone to confirm that this hacker really has the encryption keys or decryption keys to unlock this, sort of give you proof of life that they can unlock what they've locked up on your system. Do we know how to do that? Absolutely not. Someone the insurance company provides can do that.
Yeah, and I think we'll talk about it on exercise, but I think it's a good thing is kind of running through those scenarios, so really making them very tangible in regards to either maybe it's ones that, you know, peer firms have been exposed to, or you can get examples of others that you know, that have gone through, and then just working those through with your insurer to say, you know, would that be covered, would that not be covered? The other thing is understanding when it kicks in and when you need to notify, because you may, you know, one of these things of, you know, do we suspect we have an incident? Well, we may not. When do we want to notify? When you notify may determine, you know, kind of what kind of coverage you're going to get and how much coverage you'll end up getting. So I think you're kind of working that through and having a clear kind of almost playbook of when you're going to bring your insurance broker into it is, or your insurance company is going to be important.
Yeah, and given the threat we're seeing or we've heard about with companies having their data either threatened to be exposed or ransoms, and some of these ransoms we're hearing getting pretty high, one of the primary things that this will cover is the sort of extortion element. If you're going to have to pay $1 million to get your data back or get it unlocked, that's exactly what the insurance is going to cover and what your existing insurance probably will not cover. But, you know, different policies cover different things. So really want to do a gap analysis as Carl says, as you run through these different, you know, situations, figure out, okay, would that be covered? And then figure out how you fill in the gaps with cyber coverage.
So you also mentioned with respect to insurance and if somebody's tricked, maybe not being covered, maybe taking the flip then of the customers and counterparties being compromised. How do you deal with insider threats?
So in terms of one thing we're particularly worried about is, you know, insider threats and bad leavers, people who leave the company and have inside knowledge about how to expose us, and I'm sure you guys deal with it as well. Again, we deal with processes and procedures. We instituted a process a few years ago where we're small enough to do it. It's not going to work for everybody. And I go back to that, you know, the NFA's interpretive guidance really focuses on that. It's got to be, they allow you to customize, and we customize it for us because we have about, you know, 130 employees. But anytime someone leaves the company under any circumstance, whether it be good or bad, we have a committee, an ad hoc committee that gets together from HR, technology, legal, compliance, and the person's supervisor, and we go through everything, make sure all the passwords are turned off. If they worked with an outside vendor, make sure that login and password is eliminated. If they had any sort of administrative rights on any software in the company, that's discovered. So that was one of the primary things we did to prevent bad leavers, which is one of the main things that we worry about from an inside perspective.
Yeah, I mean, in the insider part, it gets pretty difficult at times because, you know, look, you want to trust your employees. That's why you hire them. So there is that level of, you know, kind of trust you want to provide, but you also have the responsibility for oversight. I think in regards to people leaving the firm, you know, one of the other things that we've done and other firms are doing is kind of, you know, people don't just like wake up one day and leave. They usually anticipate it. So kind of looking back 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, what activities have they been doing as they're leading up, you know, have they been starting to take information, have they been doing excessive printing, whatever the case might be, but kind of understanding that, you know, these aren't spur of the moment things that they do. I think the other thing that we do from a technology standpoint, when you look at Insider, is, you know, trying to overlap controls in regards to Can you have two people do something? Does it really have to sit with one person? For technologists in particular, privileged access is important. Do they need permanent privileged access or can it be temporary? Can they check out credentials when they need them, do their work, and then check them back in so that you don't have, you don't have kind of permanent root access to servers or systems that are out there. And then lastly, I think the insider piece that's important to understand is that, you know, it's very much a person and a human element to it, and understanding that in many cases where, like, you know, your cyber incident response teams are going to be looking at things from a technology standpoint, having people understand what you want to do from an insider standpoint, whether it's prosecution, chain of custody, understand that there are specific rules that apply to that, and also, you know, you need to have those relationships in with your legal department, compliance, HR, and understand sort of kind of what's that holistic process of how do we provide the oversight, what are normal behaviors, what do we not allow, what do our policies say, and then, you know, if somebody does breach those, you know, how do we then prosecute and, you know, bring them to justice.
So we've certainly mentioned the controls and some of the checks you can put into place. Maybe we can transition into what I think both of you would agree is another integral component in training on the policies and procedures and the tips and tricks and things to be aware of. What's both of your approaches to training employees?
Sure. Yeah. So we have kind of basic general training for all employees. Very much tied to our information security policy. So, you know, are you handling data? What should you do with the data? Then we also have specific training when we talk about, like, for phishing, understanding how you might be targeted, just kind of generally making people aware of it. And that's annual training. You do it, and we'll do it from our size in a web-based format where you can make it trackable and things like that. And then supplemented by briefings from our CISO and other people, our threat intelligence teams, that will just kind of give regular updates of, hey, here's what we're seeing, here's what you should be aware of, here's how you might be targeted. And then also, when we look at the different roles that people have, we also then will do some enhanced training when we talk about privileged access and understanding why you might be specifically targeted, or if, let's say, you're in the chain in regards to making payments or transfer of funds, why, you know, what you should be aware of. And even as far down within our technology teams as our application developers. So, you know, as you're developing applications, you're doing your work inside of technology, what do you need to make aware of that you're not building vulnerabilities into what we're deploying, and understanding, kind of that's your responsibility. That, you know, in our case, kind of, you know, vulnerable code is not good code, even if it does address the business practice that it's or business function that it's supposed to do. You can't, you know, that's, you have that responsibility, as a developer, not to do that. So it's, you know, it's wide ranging. It's a lot of different perspectives. We try to make it as targeted as possible because everybody's slightly different in regards to what they should be worried about.
So we take a somewhat similar approach, but obviously we're a lot smaller. So we have training on the way in, which is typically done as part of our initial, it's an add-on to our initial compliance training that's done for all new employees. And then there is annual training for all employees on the cyber side. We usually bring in an outside person to do it from one of our vendors. As part of that, they're going to do, before they come in, they're going to do a phishing exercise and try to fool people. And some of it's kind of funny. It kind of lightens it up, but it also shows people, how easy they can fall prey to some of these phishing exercises. They're often very tailored. You know, we did one where, you know, there was free apps at the happy hour across the street, right, and everybody fell for it. And we had some other ones which were a little more obvious, but certain people fell for it and got to the point where we did something around, pretending to make changes to our 401k process, and someone went all the way through the process of giving very personal identifying information about themselves and fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. So we use that as a way to show people how easy it is to fall victim, and also to emphasize that they're sort of on the front lines, they're our first line of defense. But we also do more specific training for the people on the cyber response team, what current threats are, and then trying to figure out, okay, if that happens to us, what are we going to do, and trying to react to it, and then change policies and procedures accordingly.
So with respect to training, mentioning a lot of good topics, I know at NFA internally, we also do the internal phishing exercises. So I don't think that the risk of being attacked from a fish is going away anytime soon. But are there any other topics that you feel that need to be reinforced perhaps more frequently than an annual, here's our policies and procedures you need to be aware of.
We talk about what exactly PII is and how to handle it. You know, we talk about the sensitivity of that data, you know, how to handle personal devices, what to do if you lose your personal device, all of that kind of stuff on a pretty frequent basis, usually on a quarterly basis as part of our overall firm-wide meetings. A lot of it just seems like common sense, but I think it's just worthwhile repeating it over and over again, particularly when you're either dealing with firm proprietary information or, even more importantly, client PII, just emphasizing the importance of being, you know, prudent.
Yeah, I think where you can, I think getting the chance to sprinkle in anything around cyber into just basic training that they might be going through is helpful, just so it doesn't just become kind of this standalone module, but it really is something that you should be thinking about kind of on a regular basis, and really trying to make, you know, smart decisions about what they're doing and what risks they may be exposing the firm to in regards to, let's say, technology decisions or making business decisions. You know, simple stuff like we were talking about remote access. If you're going to connect from the Starbucks, is that really the wisest thing to go do? You know, why would you do that? Can you wait? Those kinds of things.
You know, the other thing we did, I forgot to mention, is, you know, our vendors warn us, okay, this is the newest thing out there. You should look out for, and there's one in my inbox yesterday, look out for this email, look out for this phishing attack, and then, you know, someone from the tech or the compliance side will reach out and say, hey, just if you see this, don't click on this. And that happens at least once a month, where we're warned from either the tech person learns of it or because someone spots it and then tells the tech team about it and then tells the whole firm that this is out there, or we hear from our vendor that this is out there, be on the lookout for it. And so that'll be communicated typically by email, but that happens typically at least once a month.
Right. Yeah. So that's a good point. Obviously, with the landscape continually changing, how do you keep employees up to date, even logistically, with people spread across the globe in multiple locations?
It's just the training. So we do the training, as I said, annually. It's either recorded or we do it multiple locations. And then just constant communication, either by email or in-person training.
Yeah, same. And I think also it's, you kind of hit on it, is some of these things are universal in regards to, you know, kind of how to escalate issues or report them, and also understanding, you know, in many cases, and I think, you know, other firms have had this happen, is, you know, you try to be kind of very specific in what you want to do, but in some cases we found just kind of like one place to send almost everything to works best for people, and then we can kind of triage it and see where it goes. So whether it's, you know, if it's a, you know, loss of data because of an operational issue or because of human error, well, that's fine, we'll take those, or if it's something malicious, we'll take those as well. But like, just having one place where they can go to report it becomes very helpful, and it's just very simple to follow for the employees.
So one thing that both of you touched on up front is this idea of performing a tabletop exercise and going through the motions of a potential attack. Maybe if either of you could talk through what is a tabletop exercise and how do you go about performing one.
Sure. Yeah, so we do a number of tabletops on an annual basis, both internally with specific teams, you know, cross functions, cross businesses, and then also we do them with our sector partners, whether it be law enforcement, treasury, or even other firms. But basically what you're doing is, you know, we found these work the best is, you know, they're usually somewhere between 2 to 8 hours, so, you know, something you can get done in one day. You take a scenario. You run a team through that scenario, and you can do it kind of a number of different stages. You can say, like, when we start out our exercise, we'll come up with a scenario and say, like, let's do it as a discovery. How would we do this? What actions would we take? You know, it's kind of a no-fault type of exercise. We're just trying to understand, does everybody know what they're supposed to do? Let's identify gaps, and then, you know, let's take those as action items, lessons learned, and then let's try to remediate them. So, you know, you're doing a lot of discovery. You're finding holes, you're finding things to fix. You're also doing a lot of communications, a lot of education with people as they start to understand either what your internal capability is, which in many cases, like in our business partners, they may not understand, you know, what does an incident response team do? What do they need? What kind of information would they want? You know, when do we want to specifically report something as an incident, and what does that do from a legal standpoint and a compliance standpoint? So you're being very sharp on language and what you're using with communications. You know, and then you can kind of evolve them over time and say, okay, now let's do it for kind of for score. let's do it as an evaluation. You know, did we perform well? Do our run books carry, you know, does this play out in our run books? Could we pick these up and just run them step by step, or is it, you know, kind of tribal knowledge and it's all in our heads? So, you know, it's a very helpful tool. You know, we use it a lot for a number of different, you know, again, for the purpose of discovery, education, and then also for gap analysis. And, you know, we find it very helpful.
Yeah. So we used to do them for years. We didn't call them tabletop exercises. You know, we did it as part of our BCPDR planning. We're based down in South Florida. And so we would kind of sit around and for our BCPDR committee, which is a lot of the same people on our cyber incident response, and go through, okay, if it's category 5, okay, this is going to be a disaster. What are our plans going to be? Okay, category 4, this is going to be a disaster. What are our plans going to be? Category 1, okay, this is what we're going to do. And, you know, just kind of go through the different things and figure out what's going to happen. And then we tried to do it for cyber, and we said, okay, we're subject to a ransom attack. All our systems are locked up. Now what? And it was sort of like complete silence. It was like, okay, we clearly need to figure out what we're going to do if this happens. And it was helpful because it showed, well, we had no clue. Okay, how are we going to get, I mentioned before, anybody have a Bitcoin account? So we had to pay Bitcoin. You know, someone in ops had a Coinbase account. Well, that's not very helpful. How are we going to negotiate with the hackers? Anybody here have experience with that? No. How do we confirm that the hacker can actually do what they say they're going to do? We had no clue. So for us, it was eye-opening that if we were going to be attacked, we had no idea what we were going to do. You know, one of the most interesting things that came out of it when we did it was learning, you know, we talk about backup systems, and you have to have backup systems and, you know, be able to restore from backup. What we learned was, you know, our backup system is great, but it takes a long time to restore from backup, and it was going to be very disruptive to our business. And that tabletop exercise taught us that our current backup system is not where we wanted it, and it led to a goal of the firm to have a backup system that could be really, truly up and running within 24 hours. And so we completely changed our vendors, redid our whole backup system, hired vendors to help us with negotiating with hackers, figuring out how we get access to Bitcoin, all that kind of stuff. From one tabletop exercise, which started with a complete silence, people around the room saying, I don't know, to now I think we have a good process if that were to happen to us. So it was useful because it showed how little we knew what to do.
Yeah. It's also, I think, you know, if you have kind of theories about where you might have gaps and things like that, it's a good way to kind of demonstrate to, let's say, senior executives or others where you may want to get funding to say, look, you know, you may think this is in place. Let me show you what's there. And it can give you a real sense of, kind of to your point, kind of where do we stand? What do we have to do? What do we maybe want to buy? And you know, so you get to a point where kind of you have like a more holistic decision on kind of what you're going to have in place.
Okay, well, we are right up about on time. We're happy to take any questions if there are any. Got a couple up here.
Thank you. Quick question. Could the panel just talk about whether in the US, if you've got European citizen data, whether you're complying with GDPR regulations? And if so, how?
We are. It's not something that's very simple to do. I know we spent probably about 2 years preparing for GDPR. You know, I think what we're kind of waiting for right now is to see one of those first, second, third enforcement actions going to look like so that we can kind of get a sense of, you know, what language is being used, what are some of the definitions actually in practice. But, you know, it's definitely a challenge, and in many cases we've making, you know, similar to probably other firms, even technology firms out there, you know, you try to ring fence as much as you can, you know, kind of outside of that regulatory compliance. But, you know, my view on this a little, and, you know, I just give that is, that's probably the direction we're going globally anyway. So one way or another, we probably all have to comply to something similar to GDPR at some point, no matter what region we operate in.
Yeah, so we started an initiative this year trying to get to a place with best practices on these issues because we see Washington State coming down the pike. We see California coming down the pike. Cayman Islands doing something. So we're in the midst of trying to come up with sort of a best practices, which we hope gets us to 90% of what we need to do in all those jurisdictions, and then add on as each one comes down the pike. And maybe at some point there'll be some sort of federal jurisdiction which preempts all that, and we can live with that, at least in the U.S. But so for us, it's just really trying to set up a new best practice around it, and we're right in the midst of it, working with outside counsel and other experts to set it up this year. It's one of our goals for 2019.
Great, thank you. So I know it's a bit cliche, but you're only as strong as your weakest link, right? So, you know, we as financial institutions would have robust controls in place to mitigate any cyber attacks. But of course, you know, a lot of our vendors may not. So in terms of vendor contracts or third-party vendor contracts, you know, what are some of the provisions that you're putting into your contracts to make sure that there is adequate recourse should the vendor be hacked and they go into your systems? Or, you know, what are some of the provisions you're putting in there to look at, you know, make sure that there's third-party validations of their controls?
Particularly, you know, we talked about third-party administrators. You know, they're not organizations, and they are very resistant to put anything around this. We've gotten to a place where we can get, at least get notice. What we try to get, a perfect world, we'll get notice as soon as they have any sort of security incident. To the extent they can tell us, we want notice of it. And to the extent that it impacts our clients or impacts us from a monetary point of view, we're looking for indemnities from those folks. But it's sort of evolving, and we're not getting it in every case.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult. There doesn't seem to be, to your point, like kind of a universal approach that's there. It's kind of, it is literally vendor by vendor. How much leverage do you have with the vendor? Some of the things we put in, you know, kind of outside of an incident, some of the proactive things is kind of the right to audit them, the right to, you know, they have to respond to questionnaires. In many cases, like for my area, pen testing, you know, we'll very much try to write that in, that we have the ability to pen test their systems, or they have to provide us with the results of their own pen tests. So it's, you know, I think it's, you know, you try to provide a variety of things from proactive and reactive standpoint, but, you know, there really isn't kind of that one, you kind of, it is this contract negotiation on every case.
Yeah, it can be frustrating because a lot of times we'll work with large counterparties who we want to, you know, get protection from or just even better understand how they're doing things, and they're very, and I understand that they're very protective when we're doing diligence on them about how they protect their systems, but you're kind of locked out because they think it's too confidential to share with you, a client, about how they're doing things, so it leads to frustration. They're telling you, trust us. On the other hand, they're not actually letting you look under the hood. You know, they may give you very high-level summaries. I get that on one level. On the other level, I feel like it's very difficult for us to do true due diligence on our vendors to really understand, and they kind of use as a shield this idea that they can't reveal things to the world. If it gets out in the world, they'll expose themselves to attack. So we've been quite frustrated with some of our vendors and the limited ability we have to get diligence on what they're doing to protect themselves.
Great, thank you.
So maybe one more question. Oh, got one here.
Thank you. Maybe more for Carl, but certainly would like to get your view as well. Regarding the internal threat from internal actors, I know you mentioned the look back periods and things like that, but do you have like any program more on an ongoing basis? I'm thinking of something like UEBA, for instance. Do you have that?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, you'll have kind of a number of different. So from an insider standpoint, it's very much looking at behaviors. And this is very difficult to do. This isn't, you know, this is something that's very much evolving. You know, I'd say, you know, insider threat as a program really, you know, I'd say wasn't a thing 5 to 10 years ago. This is something, you know, it's very new. And a lot of the larger firms have started to invest in it. But the technology isn't there yet in regards to, you know, what is the typical behavior of, you know, John Doe? What should I expect him or her, you know, him or her to do? So, I mean, a lot of things right now we're looking at is, you know, you already have in some cases oversight programs where you look at like for insider trading and things like that. So where can you piggyback on those programs and really just sort of, you know, use those as a jump start to look at what your insiders are doing or who is the most important people, your covered employees, you know, or ones with privileged access or things like that. DLP is a big part. You know, we want to look at what data one is leaving the firm, what controls can be put into place. That's something, there's the technology is very solid around that. So, you know, what are people exfiltrating? You know, is that part of their normal job? One of the challenges with that also is like, you know, again, it goes back to behaviors. What is normal practice for that person? In some cases, you know, you look at a person and say, wow, they're sending a lot of data out, you know, on the 31st of every month. I wonder why that is. Oh, that's their normal job. that's part of the process they run. So kind of providing the context so you don't just get flooded with false positives is a big problem. And then last, I think it's, the jurisdictions you operate in from an insider standpoint. What are you allowed to do? What are you allowed to monitor for? What background checks can you do when people come into the firm? Really, the day they come into the firm, that's really, in many cases, your best chance to evaluate who you're hiring. Checking what they've done previously, and doing those for specific personnel, that re-review. Has anything changed in the last 5 years since they were hired? Have they had criminal records? Other things pop up that you may want to be aware of. So it's definitely difficult and costly, but at the end of the day, they're the ones who understand your firm the best, and are the ones that may or may not be motivated to do something.
Okay, well, please join me in thanking David and Carl for sharing their insight today. This one on. And before heading to break, we are very lucky to have one of our public directors of NFA's board here with us today, to Ron Filler, to help share some thoughts around NFA's initiatives regarding educational efforts.
Okay. My name is Ron Filler. I'm a public director here of the NFA board, and also a law professor here at New York Law School. I've been doing that now for over 11 years, where I teach a course on derivatives law, securities law, and the regulation of brokerage firms. Just to give you a little bit of my background, I started teaching a course back in 1977. We called it commodities law. Obviously, it was just the CFTC had just opened its doors. And just to show you that I can upgrade and be modern, we call it derivatives law. But two-thirds of the course I teach today was what I taught back in pretty much 1977. A lot has changed, but a lot has not changed from a regulatory point of view. And if you hear today and later this afternoon, the rest of the program today, there's two words, if you think about it, that really didn't exist 20, 30, 40 years ago, and it's called risk management. I mean, that is really the central theme of regulatory compliance, placing responsibilities, burdens on member firms to make sure they have the proper risk management process. But from my perspective, and just to share with you, one of the key facets of NFA's mission is to ensure that our members have the necessary resources to meet their regulatory obligations. Today's member workshop, starting earlier and going on through, is just one way for members to interact with NFA, to learn about your regulatory obligations, and also to discuss new initiatives. I really want to stress to all of you that NFA is constantly looking for ways to make sure our members are informed about NFA's activities and for members to contribute their thoughts and concerns via committees, the advisory committees at NFA, via the board of directors. NFA really strives to create and implement effective regulation. I want to emphasize those two words, effective regulation. That's so important in educating our members on adhering to all of the regulatory requirements. In addition to these in-person workshops, NFA also periodically conducts surveys. I'm sure you may have been part of that. And we hold a lot of webinars as well. Additionally, NFA strives to make its educational resources available to as many members as possible. For example, there will be an audio recording of today's workshop along with all the different handouts, and you will be able to find those materials on the NFA's website in a couple of weeks to share with your colleagues as well. And in the future, NFA also will post recordings of the webinars that it holds on the website as well. That said, I want to make sure that members know that they do not have to wait for these programs, these types of activities to interact with NFA. If you ever have a question, a thought, or a concern, please feel free to contact a staff member in NFA. NFA strives to create a collaborative dialogue with its members and to answer any questions and concerns that you might have. When I was in both private practice as well as in the industry, I constantly called NFA, the help desk there, as well as individuals that I knew, to make sure either my clients are in compliance or my firms that if I was in-house is in compliance. NFA, as I mentioned, really wants to have an effective regulatory approach, and we want our members to understand that they can reach out and that we are always willing to listen. Any questions that I could have? I know I'm not supposed to say this, but anybody want free legal advice I can give you? So are we having a break now, or are we having a new panel? What's the next step? Not sure.
Well, actually, I guess I have a microphone in my hand, so I can do this from right here. This will wrap up the kind of cybersecurity portion of today's workshop. So if you're heading out shortly after this, thank you for attending. Again, please feel free to fill out one of those evaluations that are on your tables. And yes, we will be taking a break until about 1:10. So if you're sticking around for our futures compliance session this afternoon, we will reconvene at that time. Thank you, everybody.